to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, on location, and have a lot to share today. The point of any broadcast, at least my broadcasts, are to empower people, to offer tools that allow you to live a longer and healthier life, to overcome disease, to solve problems, and address social issues. And we're doing all that today. We're going to start, of course, as we always do, with the latest on health and healing. Then, for all of our listeners and friends from California, we're going to give you a different perspective on what happened in the fires, and also from Professor Harvey Wasserman, an article on TruthDig, did an obsolete, poorly maintained power grid spark California fires. It's an extremely essential piece of information because all across America, our power grids are ancient, they're faulty, they're very susceptible to all forms of crisis, and yet the power companies are making record profits. They simply want to spend $1 billion dollars, which is really not a lot considering how much the government would subsidize that, and it's all tax write-offs, to help prevent a solar flare from disrupting our completely across North America. It would disrupt if it hit in our vicinity. But they're not doing it. They're not looking at the next generation of power grids that would be safer, more efficient, and less susceptible to any form of blackout in one area. And I have an expert that I've interviewed for an article I wrote on this very subject, and it'll be coming out soon, where the new grids, if anything hits them, all the others downline immediately disconnect from that. In other words, you're not going to have a cascading effect of one power grid going down, then another, 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 until you're out of electricity at the source. And that's what happened in Puerto Rico. That's why they're still out of power and won't have it for months. So we're going to talk about that. Then I'm going to also take a look at the growing menace of American authoritarianism and the dumbing down of the American mind. Not all minds, to the contrary. You see it disproportionate that for every major crisis we have, people get it. They wake up and say, okay, what can I learn from this crisis? Then they grow and they prevent it in the future. But another group of people will say, I don't know what to do. I feel overwhelmed. I'm just going to let the government do it for me. To help in this analysis, I'll be continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. And my guest will be Professor Henry Giroux, and he holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario. Quite simply, he is right there with Chris Hedges, Cornel West, and others as articulate activist scholars and thought leaders. You won't want to miss that. I don't know how long that will go, but I have a lot of other commentaries I've written, including Deconstructing the Need for America's Lockup Complex, meaning let's do what Norway does. Norway's closed over 30 prisons because there are not enough prisoners to keep them open. We, on the other hand, keep expanding because we keep making things that should never have risen to the level of criminal into criminal. Why? When reason and common sense and social understanding says, you're really going to put someone in jail because they couldn't afford a parking ticket? Did you look at the circumstances in their life, that they're too poor to pay a $40 parking ticket, so you put them in jail for the next 6 months? Now they have so much debt to a private prison complex that they could spend years in prison. And no one is writing, talking, demonstrating against this? That's authoritarianism. That is the commodification of the marketplace. I don't think we'll get that today, but I'll also give you five reasons why Donald Trump and his minions in the White House and all of Washington complex are trying to get us in a war with Iran, which we shouldn't be in. And I'll go through all the lies about Iran. Am I in favor of the theocracy? I'm absolutely opposed to all theocracies. I don't care which theocracy it would be. I'm opposed to it. But also, when was the last time Iran invaded a country? When was the last time America invaded a country? Or England? Or France? Or Italy? Now, before we start demonizing them so we can justify killing them, shouldn't we have more measured minds come in and say, let's look for the truth in this dialogue. Let's have open and honest debates. Right now in America, on MSNBC, those clowns, on Fox, you can't have open debate. What you have is you have two people from the same spectrum, but they're giving you notions to support the same, but one is more radicalized than the other, and we think somehow that's progressive. It's not. The real minds to show why we shouldn't be in any conflict with anyone are not on the air at all. So we'll have that discussion as well. So as you see, we have a lot to talk about. And tomorrow, I'm going to do something that I think is time. I'm going to have a person on the program for at least 33 minutes. It'll be in four segments of about 33 each, where we will show you in depth, in detail, with pure qualified scholarship, that the people who gave us big oil, the Rockefellers and others, they don't care about oil anymore. They don't need to make any more money off oil. But boy, are they controlling the entire genetic field. Who are they? How did they evolve? How did they do it under everyone's radar? How did they do it without an article ever being written about them? Everyone's named, their positions, the foundations they headed, how close they came to the presidency, everything that you should know about the people controlling genetic engineering. You have never heard this before, anywhere, at any time, nor read about it. You've only read scholarly support of genetic engineering or IT technologies, but you haven't seen who's involved, where they came from, and why they're the most powerful force on the planet today. That's tomorrow. Pass that along, please. Let's begin by taking a look at a study from the University of Illinois. They looked at what happens when you just don't get enough sleep. Now, it doesn't matter why you don't get enough sleep. You're way more likely to get gestational diabetes. So let's understand this. The amount of time spent sleeping in the United States has dropped significantly in the past 20 years, with almost a quarter of all women of all ages and 16% of all men experiencing insufficient sleep. And there's a price to pay for that. Now, a new study has found that lack of sleep among pregnant women may be a contributing factor to the development of gestational diabetes. The report is in the journal Sleep Medicine Reviews. Quote, links between reduced sleep duration and increased diabetes risk have been reported in several large studies in non-pregnant populations. And so they took a look at pregnant women, and that's what they found. It doesn't take much. You go to bed too late. You eat something too late at night. You have problems you take to bed with you. Your mind can't rest. You have digital appliances around you, your cell phone, your computer, your laptop, your television. You can turn them off, but if you don't unplug them, they're still on and they're still radiating this non-ionizing radiation, and it's extremely destructive to the brain, to the hippocampus, and it impacts melatonin secretion. So get your sleep, and do so. If you have to wear earplugs, do so. Any kind of light mask that you put over your eyes, you can use that if there's any light in the room that you can't turn off. And go to bed at a time when you could still stay up more, but your body needs it better to go to bed earlier, let's say 10 o'clock, and get up at 6 o'clock. Then, so you're getting your 8 hours. Then to stay up to midnight. Now, if you do it once in a while, fine. But people get into habits and they don't break them. From the Australian Black Dog Institute, 1 hour of exercise can prevent 12% of all depression. That's a big deal. And the participants undertook just 1 hour of physical activity each week. The results of the study, which was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, revealed that even small amounts of exercise can protect against depression, with mental health benefits seen regardless of a person's age or gender. The study revealed that regular exercise of any intensity can prevent further depression, and just 1 hour of exercise can do it. And Professor Samuel Harvey, the lead author of the research, stated that they had known for some time that exercise has a role to play in treating symptoms of depression. Quote, "But this is the first time we have been able to quantify the preventative potential of physical activity in terms of reducing future levels of depression. So exercise now, you prevent depression. Exercise now, and you can also help reverse it." There's several types of tea on the market. Most are good. Most come from some form of blends of green, white, oolong teas, black teas. And the latest is, of course, kombucha. Now, kombucha, com, K-O-M, bucha, B-U-C-H-A, it's been around a long time. And it's known for having lots of probiotics in it. And it has a lot of health benefits. And I just thought that this fermented tea is growing in popularity now. It's had a comeback. You didn't hear about it for 30 years. And it's been around for thousands of years. It originated in China in the 3rd century B.C. And then it became popular in India and Japan and Russia. In fact, it became a regular daily ritual for the samurai warriors to use it. Now it's all over the world. Kombucha or buch is, as people who use it all the time, generally it's black, green, and white. It's fermented for at least a week and with a fungal culture consisting of a mixture of bacteria and yeast. And the starter is called SCOBY, which is an acronym for symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. And the culture, also sometimes referred to as the mother, resembles a light brown, tough, gelatinous disc, which is a living, growing organism. And that's with each batch of the tea, the organism can regenerate and create new culture called baby, which can be shared with a friend, much like the sharing of a sourdough starter. And sometimes it's called mushroom tea, because kombucha has been associated with a long list of health benefits. And it's a probiotic, so it recolonizes good bacteria in your gut. That's very good. And it supports digestion. That's good. And that's generally all people know, but there's a lot more to know. Here's why I'm recommending it on a daily basis. First, because it's really powerful as a detoxification. And it contains what is called glucocuronic acid, or GA. And it's well known in science as a detoxicant. In the body, it combines with toxins like pharmaceuticals and environmental pollutants and carries them out of the blood. And it then converts them into compounds that are soluble and can be excreted. So you want to get rid of the toxins in your body? Kombucha. It's rich in antioxidants. It has vitamin E and C and beta carotene and other carotenoids. And also black tea kombucha contains polyphenols and other compounds in addition to antioxidants. And it's more powerful than most other teas because it's been fermented. In fact, its antioxidant activity has been found to be 100 times higher than vitamin C and 25 times higher than vitamin E. And for that reason, drinking traditional kombucha can help eliminate a lot of illnesses especially those caused by oxidative stress. Then it's great for energy. Kombucha sets iron free from black tea. That helps increase levels of blood hemoglobin, improves oxygen flow to tissues. It also stimulates immunity. You've heard me talk about oxidative stress. When you exercise, you create oxidative stress. Just normal breathing creates oxidative stress. And that can suppress, and does, the immune system. But kombucha's high level of vitamin C supports immunity, and therefore it helps prevent cell damage, inflammatory diseases, and helps if you have suppressed immunity or tumors. I mentioned how I helped one of those old American reporters, the Damon Runyon style of writing, Guy Richards, who had gastric bleeding ulcers, and I gave him raw cabbage juice, and he began to drink it, and 3 glasses a day, it was gone, all of it, and never came back. Well, kombucha is good for gastric illnesses as well. You have to remember that everyone who is taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug like an aspirin or ibuprofen, that's very toxic to your gut, and that can lead to gastric ulcers. In fact, there are many that disrupt your blood circulation to the stomach's mucous membranes. Well, kombucha has been shown to effectively heal gastric ulcers, and that's because of the fermentation impacts powerful healing in around the stomach and its mucus. Then you have obesity, and it helps balance your metabolism. It helps with diabetes. It significantly reduces blood sugar in laboratory studies in diabetes. It's good if you have kidney toxicity. It can help eliminate kidney damage by environmental pollutants, and it benefits people with renal impairment. And it's also used to prevent calcification in the kidneys and can prevent the formation of kidney stones. It has good endothelial function. You've heard me mention that the lining of the blood vessels are called the endothelium, and damage to those is a precursor to atherosclerosis, and hence a threat to the heart health. It helps there. It helps with atherosclerosis specifically. So just imagine one and all the things it does, one thing at a time: atherosclerosis, hypertension, anemia, liver function. It's terrific. Nervous system stimulation. It's good for that, and depression, asthma, joint problems, cancers. Yeah, consumption of kombucha has been associated with a lower cancer rates. And researchers believe that it increases the immune system's anti-cancer defenses. And it may prevent cancer proliferation at its earliest stage due to its what is called glucuronic acid, lactic acid, and acetic acid, as well as its antibiotic compounds. So it's antibiotic resistant. It helps, meaning it, if you have an antibiotic resistant infection, it has strong natural antibacterial qualities. So people who suffer from influenza or parathyroid fever, dysentery, it helps. That's our nutrient of the day, and that's kombucha. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back and share a lot more. Please stay with us.
Get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I want to share some insights of my own and Professor Harvey Wasserman from Truth Dig. I spoke extensively yesterday on our sister station, WBAI, where I've been for 41 years, about, okay, we've had a fire, big fire, multiple fires, people have died. Could it have been prevented? Could people have gotten out? Could there have been a better system in place? And the answer is yes to all those. Now, we cannot in and of itself prevent all fires, because a lot are done by lightning, others by carelessness. But what if the fire in California was due to a poorly maintained power grid sparking a fire? Well, the raging fires and toxic smoke clouds pouring through Northern California, how would you describe it? It would not be extreme or hyperbole to say it was apocalyptic. Were they sparked by Pacific Gas and Electric centralized grid? And where is our federal government and national media? Yeah, the media did cover it, but they didn't ask a lot of the questions I would have asked. That disappoints me. More than 40 people are dead. I'm sure many more will be discovered. And many more than that, far more, are missing. Hundreds are missing. Well, given how fast the fires race through the region, we have to understand we don't even have any idea how many of the wildlife, bears, mountain lions, foxes, wolves, we have no idea how many of them are dead. And of course, a lot of little creatures would have no place to go, like squirrels or rabbits. And very few would be able to get into a lake or a stream and be protected, because the area wasn't known for that. Even people's pets were incinerated. Now, here's what we know to date, and this may change, but in many cases, the margin for escape was 5 minutes or less. Some people who did not leave their homes at the first sign of danger died. Some people actually stood in their swimming pools for hours, all night, while everything around them burned to the ground. And then flames leaped over Highway 101 and other major roads, creating firestorms with temperatures as high as 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. Now, much of the quiet and comfortable town of Santa Rosa, it now looks like Hiroshima after the bombing. Whole neighborhoods have been reduced to smoldering ash. Homes, businesses, factories, farms, at least 5,700 buildings to date and counting. That does not include gardens or vineyards, cars, and of course, the forests themselves were all vaporized. I mentioned the other day that there was a car, and you could see these little pools of molten steel. To melt steel on a car frame has to be awful hot. And how could so many cars get incinerated? Well, if there's no way to get people out, and they haven't been told this is the road out, and if there was no siren, which there was not, and if there was no fire alert, which was not, and if there was no central irrigation system that could have flooded the entire urban area, including all the homes, immediately within 5 seconds it goes on, and you have thousands of gallons of water soaking in the land and the houses, then you're going to lose it. But you could have saved it, a lot of it, and you certainly could have saved these lives if any of the things I just mentioned were in place. If building codes required outside sprinkler systems, so the entire house is lined with a water system, you couldn't see it, it would not change the aesthetics of the home, and it's very inexpensive. But the moment, just like a smoke detector that detects smoke, the moment this detects heat or fire or smoke, it automatically comes on and soaks your roof, your sides, and of course all the lawn around you. So in effect, it's like pouring a water hose over you as fire approaches. Was it required and mandatory that everyone in every house have a complete fire suit, which are not expensive, they're in the hundreds of dollars, that would have protected and saved lives? No. Was there any requirement to have oxygen, portable oxygen, so if a person was trapped and they only had their bathroom and they got on the bathtub and think, okay, I'm all right, and then realize they're going to suffocate to death because of the smoke. If they had a gas mask on or air mask, air tank, they could have survived. No. Was there any requirement to have the inside of a house with sprinkler system? No. Now imagine the inside of a sprinkler system, the outside sprinkler system, a gas mask, and you had yourself, even for pets, you had a fire suit that you could put on him, then even though you may have been at risk of losing some, your lives have been protected, your pets protected, and also a lot of the buildings would not have burned. Was it required that each home have the amount of fire-retardant material, which will last for years, stored in their garage so that knowing a fire was coming, they could go out and spray the house with fire retardant? It looks like a big, looks like you put shaving cream on the side of a house. That stops an awful lot. You put water, then fire retardant, very few homes will burn. The answer was no. Was it required anyone have a ladder, a metal ladder that you could put on the side of your house and go up there and just start up there and just spray everything? 10 minutes, you got your house sprayed. No. Was it required that you bring in outside environmental building and sustainable environment experts from the universities who have no affiliation with any builder or financial group, who will then, before any development is approved, be able to have the final word? It's their say-so. Is this area capable of supporting life and being sustainable without also being highly susceptible to devastation? And if they look at the evidence and say, yes, you could live here, and here's why, and they lay out their arguments, that's good. But what if they say, right now and for years past, we're in a fire zone. We have no way of stopping it, and if it's in the woods, we don't have a budget for that. The President of the United States just cut $300 million out of the fire budget. So all we have here is what you see. It's not sustainable. Then you don't allow the building there to begin with. The trouble is, wherever there's a desire for people to go, whether it was Arizona or Flagstaff or Naples, Florida, or Palm Springs, Palm Beach, it's always overdeveloped. What starts out of as almost a beautiful place becomes highly congested and then becomes no longer the quiet, beautiful place. Too many people wanting to be in a place, and no one's thinking about, should I actually live here? Is this sustainable? And even if at one point it was sustainable and safe, if the weather has changed, therefore you have to change your mind. This whole idea, well, I'm going to stay here because I planned on staying here. I want to retire here, so I'm going to retire here. That doesn't work. If today, staying there because you have a one time or up to this point a beautiful place, but now you've got fires and you've got hurricanes and you're on an earthquake fault, or you're in a drought zone, or you're running out of drinking water, any one of these would be reason not to be it. Now, what if you're in a place that has all those? Then it's suicidal. But politicians will not interfere with those who pay them large sums of money. And that's where you have to trust outside, non-affiliated authority and experts to give you input. So you can ask yourself, is it reasonable? I lived in Miami Beach for 15 years on South Beach on Ocean Drive. I was there before anyone else. There was only one other building, and from Fifth Street clear down to the end of the island, there was nothing. It had been a ghetto. Nobody wanted to live there. And I saw how beautiful it was, and so I lived there, ran on the beach every morning until I saw the tides coming in at night, no rain, no storm, the sea level was rising. And I was reporting on it. I was researching it. I was doing a documentary on it. I'm just about to release a major report on it itself, which is a whole book, a 1,000-page book. So I did my homework, and I realized there's nothing humans can do to prevent this from happening. What we don't know is how fast it will happen. You listen to developers. You listen to realtors, you listen to someone trying to say, oh, you don't have to worry, you know, you'll be long dead 100 years from now, you know, the water might come up to your door, but not now. Well, now the water's up to everyone's door, and it's been up to their door for the last 5 years. And yet they put in $220 million worth of water pumps, didn't do any good. They take the water out of the street, like you have West Street is the last street, but the main street is going up is to meet Lincoln Road. And that's why everyone lives in South Beach, because this wonderful, magnificent road with no traffic on it, no cars, called Lincoln Road, where you have theaters and symphonies and comedy clubs and restaurants and all lushly landscaped. It is just a jewel. I've been all over the place, and I've never seen another city that I felt, except for Paris, had done as much to beautify one single place. And it's tropical all the time, and wonderful people. You meet people from South America. It's some very sophisticated minds you can run into on Lincoln Road. But Alton Road is what comes up. That's how you take Alton Road. Flooded every night, up to 18 inches. I remember one night driving up through there and opened the car door, water rushed right in. I'm thinking, this is really high. No flooding. That's just the nightly tidal surge. And now we can see that you can get a 9-foot, 10-foot, 15-foot surge. 15-foot, you're going to go into the first and second story of a building. That means everything destroyed. And that also means the foundation that building's sitting on. Every single building, from Key West, clear up the coast, clear up through West Palm Beach, clear up through going way up to northern Florida, then up through there. There's nothing but sand. Those pylons are sitting not on concrete or a rock. They're sitting on sand. So they're going to be washed out, and all those buildings are going to become structurally unsafe. You're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. So at what point do you wait until you're the last person off a dangerous place? But that means politicians have to be honest. They won't be. Even when forced to be, they won't. Look at how politicians have dealt with Puerto Rico, leaving people to starve to death and die of thirst or be forced to drink toxic water, and not willing to help them rebuild from scratch a new power grid that is actually efficient and not run by corrupt people as the last one was. They won't. Piecemeal little efforts, and then on to the next crisis. So I'm just sharing this with you because where at once Santa Rosa was wonderful, I wouldn't live there for anything. I wouldn't rebuild anywhere in California. If I could get out of California, I'd get out of California. The amount of dollars lost is incomprehensible. Hundreds of square miles of the world's most vital, lush terrain have been obliterated. And much of the fallout now is entering the lungs of some 7.6 million people in the Bay Area. The cloud recalls the dust and ash that coated New York City after the World Trade Center. And the Environmental Protection Agency failed to evacuate Manhattan and did not warn area residents to wear protective clothing and masks. Years later, its then-chief, remember, former governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, issued a public apology. Well, you can forget your public apology, Ms. Whitman. You made political decisions, and that is immoral what you did. That was a crime against humanity. And not just the people who died at the Trade Center, as horrific as that was, but how about the millions who now have some form of affected immune system collapse and pulmonary conditions because these are the first responders. I was there. I was doing my run. In fact, it's up on my website. There's a picture of me in the World Trade Center as that disaster is happening. None of us knew what was going to happen. None of us knew the devastation of going in there. But Americans will always run in the direction of a crisis in order to, you know, that's part of who we are. Other countries have the same. You want to help the people who are being devastated. We didn't know the dust and the ash would be in our lungs. And that cloud contained arsenic, lead, mercury, zinc, cadmium, creosote, furans, dioxins, and much, much more. A devil's brew of toxic chemicals perfectly designed to kill large number of beings over the short period of time. The cloud now swirling over the Bay Area and Northern California contains huge quantities of wood smoke, which can be toxic, and health authorities have warned people to stay inside and be especially protective of their children and elders. Bay Area residents have been urged to wear masks, but hospital-grade masks don't filter out particulate matter. The heavier-duty N95 masks might help, but existing supplies have sold out. The idea that FEMA or the military would bring in supplies of more effective protective gear. Well, do you really think our government's ever going to do anything that makes sense? Of course not. So, Mark Summer, a Bay Area author and renewable energy advocate, noted that thousands of people fled to shelters in Napa and Sonoma counties. He says, quote, many Bay Area residents seem in denial of the hazards they face, even at their distance from the fire. Even some jog through the haze, pumping lethal chemicals deep into their lungs. And Summer, whose view from the 27th floor of an Emeryville, California high-rise faces the Golden Gate and Marion headlands, and says visibility has been as low as a quarter of a mile, and it's on some days as bad as a day in Beijing. And by the way, as of yesterday, which makes it 10 days after the fire began, the biggest fires are about 50% contained, but that's only because the winds have died down. What has not been welcome is the profound neglect of this catastrophe by the federal government and major media. By and large, the story of this unparalleled cataclysmic event played second fiddle to Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein's sordid and sorry sex life. I'll deal with that on an upcoming program. But just as an aside, why is it that the star of the Harry Potter film series can go and say that pedophilia reigns in Hollywood at the highest level? And I think it was Ashton Kutcher talked before Congress about this. And I believe Brad Pitt also did. And others have. Do you think anyone in Hollywood is unaware of the most powerful people, including heads of studios, who have engaged in pedophilia with minorities and underage children, I should say? No. So if Harvey Weinstein and shaming him and holding him accountable for the absolutely titanic amount of abuse he leveled on people because he ran a studio, if they finally say no more, then why haven't they said no more about pedophilia? It's epidemic. I'm going to name names and call them out and have people on the show who were victims of Hollywood's epidemic of pedophilia. And a whole lot of people, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, have been engaged in it. So give me a break, you moral asses in Hollywood. If you can't go all the way and call out in the music industry, the sex slave business, and the fashion industry, equal, and in so many other places that we somehow think are immune from this, we're not. We'll do a really powerful show in the next couple of days on this. So what we have is this. Needless to say, Trump has declined to come to California, at least up to this point, or seriously discuss this, because I guess he's needed on the golf course. But there's a gargantuan tragedy with the media, or even in their deranged tweets. No emergency panels have been convened. There's no dramatic mobilization of FEMA and federal resources to help the multitude of taxpaying Americans whose lives have been destroyed and whose health and survival are still under fire. And the widespread assumption is that because California is largely non-white and voted overwhelmingly against Trump in 2016, he has less interest in helping people here than he did in Puerto Rico. He has, however, continued to gut federal protections against global warming and to push a power ban based on fossil fuels and nuclear reactors. Conversely, here's what Summer says. The most important story here has been the deeply impressive response of emergency personnel and local authorities and firefighters and surrounding communities offering shelter and supplies to the stricken victims of the fires. It's the strength of local communities that provides the essential resilience required to deal with the cascading calamities of our new normal. Well, that new normal, there's widespread speculation that this entire catastrophe might have been sparked by an obsolete pole and wires grid that is owned and badly maintained by Pacific Gas and Electric, the region's dominant utility, and that's according to Mercury News, and tied to an aging network of decrepit fossil-fired power plants such as the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors surrounded by earthquake faults near the San Obispo area this massive Rube Goldberg grid was, by many accounts, poised for disaster. And the Mercury News investigation has raised the question of why the wind knocked down so many power lines. And according to reporter Paul Rogers and Lisa Krieger and Matthias Gaffney, the power company is legally required to guarantee its poles can withstand hurricane-force winds, but the Mercury News says many collapse in the weaker winds has sparked the fires. That would lead to the nightmare scenario of a grid fire catastrophe. In addition to providing wind-resistant poles, the power company is required to keep the right-of-way under its power lines free from undergrowth. It also must trim nearby trees so branches and trunks don't fall on the wires, shorting them out. The Mercury News cast serious doubt on whether that was done as required by law. So we're going to be taking a deeper look at this PG&E because it's got some really bad things going on. In fact, in 1994 alone, the company was convicted on 739 counts of malfeasance and fined $30 million after its high-voltage lines were hit by falling trees and resulted in fire destroying 12 homes and a vintage schoolhouse. And prosecutors showed that the company had taken some 80 men meant for tree cutting, which might have prevented the fires, and used it to expand their profits. So this is really a sordid company. But then again, they're dealing with the Public Utilities Commission. And so all of California needs to pay attention in the rest of the country as well, because we've got these kind of grids everywhere. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for joining us. Now we're going to go over to our guest who is standing by to talk about the growing menace of American authoritarianism and the dumbing down of the American mind, with Professor Henry Giroux, whose background and biography I gave you earlier in the program. Nice to have you with us today, Henry.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
80 years ago, Aldous Huxley predicted it would take 600 years to turn the American dream into a nightmare of consumerism and zombie-like conformity and uniformity and a drug culture for relieving every physical mental ailment. And yet it's taken less than a century since Huxley's prediction, and we're at that point. And recently, Dr. Alan Francis, head of the psychiatry department at Duke University, and who chaired the fourth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry's task force, that's the mental health industry's Bible for mental health diagnostics, which he later denounced, but no one paid attention to his denouncing, has been writing that American sanity has reached its twilight zone, and Trump is a reflection of this insanity. In some ways, the debate over Trump's mental health is a distraction from the larger problem of our culture's mental state, which is becoming increasingly violent, predatory, misogynist, militaristic, and, quite frankly, in my opinion, insane. We blindly pursue happiness in all the wrong places and ways. We've forgotten how life is supposed to be lived. We've forgotten about the depth that comes from authentic fulfillment and coming from love and peace. So we look at tyrants and authoritarian masters if we're not happy to make our lives better. This is what Trump's delusions promised his supporters, many of who were seriously struggling in their own lives and feeling helpless. But still, they support the decay and loss of democracy while believing they are supporting it. And as you have noted, and I'm going to ask you in a moment to take the form and run with it, American authoritarianism is largely a result of the collapse of education. So please begin by drawing the connecting lines, failure of American education with the rising support for a postmodern fascism. The form
is yours. I mean, I think that what you have to understand is that this is a country that forgets that when you look at the 1960s, when education was linked to certain democratizing goals and principles, later the Republican Party and a number of other extremists in the Democratic Party saw that as one of the greatest dangers that America faced. And they, as you well know, you have the Powell Memo of 1971, then you have the Trilateral Commission report that came out later, arguing that democracy was in excess, that we didn't need this democracy was dangerous. And I think that what they really were saying was that education was dangerous. And I think that particularly since the 1970s, what we've seen is not only the funding of education, but we've seen a funding of a whole range of pedagogical sites in the mainstream media to the public schools to basically a higher education, what I would call massive forms of illiteracy, meaning that we do everything we can to dumb down the intelligence of students, to condemn dissent, to turn the mass media into insipid entertainment centers, and to celebrate at another level what I call the militarized spectacle of violence. And so I think that what you're getting is you're getting two things connected here. You're getting both a crisis in civic literacy along with a crisis in civic culture and the erosion of any sense of shared citizenship. And you're getting at another level an incessant call for elevating a series of principles and a series of values that basically are enormously undemocratic and enormously civically illiterate. The elevation of self-interest to one of the highest ideals, the militarization of everyday life, the notion that private happiness is a private right, the flight from public service, the claims that government don't have any responsibility, the notion that the market is the template for solving all problems. I mean, I think all of these issues basically function to do two things. They function to depoliticize people, and they depoliticize them by making them unable to think through the basic conditions that affect their lives. And so they all of a sudden hear a guy like Trump who comes along, who's the endpoint of this kind of economic, political, and religious fundamentalism, a fundamentalism rooted essentially in a form of ignorance and mass illiteracy, and they look for saviors. I mean, the only community that they have left is the community of ignorance. And a community of ignorance is always a friend-enemy community. It simplifies and it blames. And in this case, it simplifies the problems that America faces, and it blames others for them, you know, whether they be Muslims, whether they be DACA children, whether they be blacks, and it goes on and on. I mean, you basically have a notion of illiteracy now that functions as a form of racial cleansing. It's part of what I call a larger politics of disposability, which is now central to the abyss of authoritarianism that the United States has basically dropped into.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. You have noted that for many of the great activists for social justice, education is crucial for opposing ignorance and extremism and injustice. And on this account, our institutions of higher learning and our entire elementary public school system is, in my personal opinion, Henry, failing dismally. But that begs the question for our postmodern dystopian times, what actually differentiates a viable humanistic education from what is being spoon-fed to students today? And what are the qualities that we want students and young adults to embody from an education that is not being provided to them right now?
Well, I mean, let's start with what is being provided, and then we can move to what education should actually be about. I mean, you have to make a distinction between education and training. And I think that in the current dystopian moment in which you don't have reformers, you have educational disinformers, which is what I call them. They're not concerned with education. They're concerned with training. They're concerned with basically killing the imagination so that people can be adjusted to low-paying jobs, and in some cases, not jobs that pay anything, just simply, you know, volunteeristic internships. Treating kids to a curriculum that is basically about memorization, teaching to the test, taking away the conditions that allow teachers to have some autonomy, destroying teacher unions, which are the only protection that teachers have against corporate power and corporate intrusion into the educational system. On the other hand, you know, there are a whole range of people we can speak to who are great educators, from Dewey to Paulo Freire to Martin Luther King Jr., who said, look, education should function as a democratic public sphere. It should teach kids how to think critically. It should inspire. It should energize. It should give them a general education in which they can make connections. They can understand totalities. It should teach them about the global world. It should draw from the various disciplines and move beyond them. It should take the best that's been taught and teach young people. We should give kids an enormous instruction in a number of literacies, whether we're talking about print culture, we're talking about visual culture, and we should tie all this to a particular goal, and that is, how is learning linked to both deepening and strengthening the possibilities of democracy. And what does it mean to inject an ethical element into the curriculum in which people learn how to care for others, how to be compassionate and not just socially responsible and not just simply well-rounded, but also compassionate and to, in some way, recognize that education is about all of us. You know, it's about how we can survive together in a world to make it the best of all worlds. And I think that when you link education to democracy, that's what happens. When you link it to training, you basically create people who are incapable of understanding the conditions that make democracy possible and what their role might be in basically taking up those conditions.
I'd like to follow up one part of what you just said, because recently I've been very bothered by the rampant sexual abuse in this country. And even worse, the U.S. is now one of the world's capitals for child pornography. And the current Harvey Weinstein affair is simply a case that is otherwise pervasive throughout Hollywood. I had several friends that lived in Hollywood. One was a producer. He was actually not a set producer. He was the money person behind that no one ever saw, who financed the films. And one evening, we're out on his terrace that overlooked all of Beverly Hills, and it was beautiful at night with the big sky and the lights sparkling. And he turned to me and says, "You're so lucky you live in New York." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "I'm so sick of this town, Gary." He said, "The people that show up on the news that get all the awards out here for humanitarian efforts and running studio, they're all real degenerates." And I thought for a moment he was just, you know, angry about something and venting. He said, "No, Gary." He said, "If the world ever knew the truth of how many powerful studio heads and directors and producers and casting directors use everything they can in their power to manipulate a people for sex, and it's especially bad when it comes to the children or young people out here, especially young men." And I thought, well, why don't you do something about it? And we had that conversation. I said, "If you know something, shouldn't you say something?" Everybody in this town knows what's going on. But no one's going to say anything, Gary, because the day you do, this town is a community that supports the industry. And everybody will be shocked, shocked, shocked at one case, and yet they're all participating or aware of it. So that said, when we look at at this, where the majority of the people who are aware of what's going on, Hollywood doesn't actually educate anyone about anything urgent or important, in my opinion, except in rare instances. So there's a battle between our culture, entertainment, and its obsession with sexuality and becoming a critically thinking and informed human being. So does Hollywood, the entertainment industry, and its sexual culture contribute in any way to the sex violence or the rise in authoritarianism in any way?
Of course it does. I mean, look, you're not just talking about entertainment. You're talking about a form of public pedagogy. I think we make a big mistake in sort of painting Hollywood as an entertainment center. Hollywood teaches people things. Hollywood normalizes certain forms of behavior. And I think that one of the things that we've seen recently is that it normalizes a form of hypermasculinity that's tied to a form of extreme violence, particularly against women. At the same time, it's reproduced in the most degenerate forms all the forms of sexism that feminists, particularly in the 1960s and the 70s, were fighting against. We don't have Hollywood now is about the representations of forms of masculinity that basically are not just about Hollywood. They're about the culture in general. And I think we make a terrible mistake when we sort of look at people like Harvey here, and assume that these are personal issues, because they all of a sudden become lifestyle issues. We're not talking about lifestyle. We're talking about systemic sexism. We're talking about systemic forms of hypermasculinity. We're talking about the militarization of the culture in general. And until you begin to connect the dots between a culture that's highly militarized, highly sexualized, and saturated in violence, you miss the point. You don't see it in its totality. You don't see how these different spheres, from Hollywood to the schools, to what's happening on campuses with fraternities, what's happening with the celebration of military heroes, what's happening at sports events, when all of a sudden you have, people celebrate, where the military spends hundreds of thousands of dollars to celebrate its death march and its machineries of death. I mean, until these things are all connected, we're going to miss the point. But I think at the same time, you know, one of the things that is absolutely crucial is to make power visible and the mechanisms that allow it to legitimate and normalize the worst dimensions of what we might call various forms of oppression. So the key here is, how do you tie these different spheres together and begin to ask the question, what values, what politics, what relations of power at work that allow these egregious acts of oppression and sexism and militarism and hyper-masculinity to both reinforce each other and at the same time to be named so they can be dismantled?
Well said. And once again, Henry, you bring us a lot to consider. Thank you very much, and all the best on The Public in Peril, Henry Giroux's new book, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. The website is Henry A. Giroux, that's GIROUX.com. Henry, until we speak again, have a nice time.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Some folks know about